Hey, thanks for coming today. I appreciate it. And this is the Massengale Lecture. And for those of you who don't know, this is sponsored by Martin and Ruth Massengale. And Martin is the past chancellor at the University of Nebraska. And a great guy, wonderful person to work with. Martin's about 84 now. I'm not sure if he's here today, but still comes to work every day. Or I guess goes to work every day, not in Nebraska anymore. But Martin is wonderful to work with. And so he's still very active within the universe or within the university. And so he... He's underwriting this seminar series or this lectureship really to highlight people who have made contributions in any part of the turf of the industry. It alternates between turf, crop, and forages, and so it alternates every 3 years. And so, very generous donation by Martin. And so, we're thrilled today to have Dr. Kirk Hurdle speak with us. And Kirk has been with True Green since the dark ages. 38 years, and I was joking with lots of people. Kirk has probably interviewed all of us in the room in one way, shape, or form, and probably refused to hire most of us in the room in one way, shape, or form. And so for the last 38 years, he has really shaped the lawn care industry. Because you think about all the guys who are out there with pickups and all the good companies that we have out there, all the research, all of the size of the industry, it probably wouldn't have happened in the way it has happened without a guy like Kirk. And so, and I guess, Kirk, you took the job thinking you were going to be there for 3 years? That a boy, stick to it. So with no further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Kirk Hurdle. And again, this we have 45 minutes here. Kirk has a number of slides, but feel free to, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Feel free to interrupt, ask questions. You know, because Kirk is a great guy, speaks from the heart, and so he will call it like it is. And so please interrupt if you like, or if you disagree with him, don't say anything. So, Kirk, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Zach.
I believe we drive just by.
I'll let you
in the bottom.
I don't know. This thing don't blow up, I may well.
When Zach called me about this, you know, I wasn't certain what the whole seminar was about, and he said, well, you know, you're retired now. I said, you know, there was a quote Mark Twain about your obituary preceding your death. I said, I'm still active, so, but I've known Zach for a number of years, and in fact, I did interview him at one time in his career, so.
And did not hire me.
Did not? Well. but, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about more of a story, if you will. My beef background was... I didn't know what the heck I wanted to do when I started college. I started out in forestry, realized I wasn't going to be Yogi the Bear. So I dropped out and went to work on a golf course for a summer with the intent to go back to school. Now my wife, who I'm now married to, but at the time we were dating, and her father didn't like that idea. But I went back to school, got my undergrad, had a job ready to start on a golf course because I was nosy, always asking questions. I was asked to do graduate work. The idea to get a master's, and then I was blessed to be picked up by Al Turgeon as his first PhD student. So a lot of great people came through that program. I wish Al was here today. I owe a lot to him. Went there to a university position, had a great run, loved it, and all of a sudden I get a knock on the door by one of my colleagues at Kelmont. He said, hey, I'm moving to another position. I need you to be a weed scientist for us. And three times I said no, and then I got smart, took it, and literally I was going to do it for 3 years. The day I walked in, I was a little misgiving about giving up some of my graduate student responsibilities. I never turned back. It's just been a great run. I'll talk about some of the people, but many of you don't know, but there was a gentleman that probably had more insight than a lot of us, was Dr. Robert Miller. He was the head full professor at Ohio State. He had a young entrepreneur come in his office one day, said, I'm a garden center. And I got customers that come in to figure out how to put the granular products on the lawn, and you've all seen the pictures, used them about improper application. So Bob Miller started teaching and helping this guy do development work. He had a sod farm and a lot of trial and error. And next thing you know, he hires Bob Miller. Here's a guy, full tenured professor, 20-some years under his belt, took the risk, left, because he believed in what this guy had as a vision. With that, he knew science had to be part of any discussion on this. And I was probably the third PhD hired underneath him. But when I came on board, there was a fledgling R&D group. Many came from our C5 group. Dr. Dave Martin, who was at OSU as a faculty member. Before him, Dr. Jim Wilkinson, who was at OSU. Dr. Chuck Dara, who was at University of Maryland, was heading up our fertility. We had an entomologist out of Michigan State, Dr. Keith Kennedy. And then we had a horticulture entomologist named Dr. Doug Caldwell. I had a pathologist from Virginia Tech, Dr. Bobby Joyner. So I joined a young group of guys that really worked as a team. And I can't stress that word enough because we were extremely collaborative. In fact, the first building in, we all shared two of us to an office. And from there, we developed it, and it's been a great run. So C5 is foundational to what we were able to do, is understanding what the customers want, understanding what are the products that we need to do, and evolved over time. In many of the talks I've been sitting in on today is what I'm seeing some of the stuff we did. So, for example, I was at a seminar yesterday on carbon sequestration under urban landscapes. We did a study a bunch of years back, and people said, well, pesticides, fertilizers, they're killing the soil's biology. And you're making them, and they use words, well, they're chemically fixed. I went to my our president, I said, we need to understand whether we've got problems. And he said, well, what if we find a problem? I said, well, we'll know about it, and we'll change. So we did that work back in the 90s. I funded a PhD program to do that work, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Dislodgeable residues, we heard a talk yesterday afternoon on that. We had to get in some of that work because the real question is when can a family safely reenter a property? And in the early days, there wasn't a whole lot of data on that. The EPA had some risk models, but there was no database. It was all on modeling. So we got involved in that. So I guess what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about where things have come, challenge you as scientists to look at what kind of work you're doing in this area. I think there's a lot of excellent work that's going on the last few years. I'm going to leave you with a challenge of what I think the future is. So that's kind of where I want to go with things. And Zach has volunteered. I'm more than willing to field some questions. But let me start with some foundational knowledge. Basically what we have today in our suburban urban areas of the United States is the post-World War II. A lot of our parents came back, and you saw these tract homes coming up. First home I lived in was pretty modest, but far extensive compared to what my dad grew up in. So all of a sudden you have little mini farms, if you will, in an urban community. So that really became the start of what we know today as lawn care. Currently, Americans spend about $40 billion a year on lawn care, and that includes people just going down to the hardware store or to a big box store and picking up products and putting it down themselves. And when you look at it today, the professional lawn care industry, which is an extension of that, really represents about 16% of the total market. So really, the do-it-yourselfers are really the largest driver of this growth. Some do it extremely well, and some, as you know, need a little bit of help. You're seeing in the service sector of America today a lot of outsourcing. Basically, professional lawn care is just an outsourced service. It's a very emotive buy. I'll talk a little bit about that. But with the drivers of customer satisfaction, probably not too dissimilar in other areas. We heard a talk today about sports turf, comparing this in synthetic and natural. We talked about some visual quality scores just the earlier session. So there's a lot of things that you folks are doing today that can really transfer over an understanding of it. The other thing we need to be mindful of is there's some people misunderstand what the size is. Out of all the households in America, only 1 in 2 does anything with their lawn. So it's, you know, people think that, you know, this stuff's going on, but it really isn't. And there's so much information that's taken out of context. But you know, the science will prevail. You've got different state agencies, federal agencies that are provides our checks and balance. And basically some of the fundamental research that this society has done has been helpful in getting a better, clearer picture, but there's still room for improvement. So let's talk about where we started. What I've done here is try to look at what has happened over time and where I got involved in it. So C5 was kind of in its infancies in the 60s and 70s. You know, you look at some of the former fellows, Jim Beard is a good example, really wrote the book on it, paved the way for many of us. Al Turgeon was a student of his. So you can see there, we're probably in our third, possibly our fourth generation of scientists that have come through from the early 60s with C5. The scientific research back then was rather limited. A lot of our earlier C5 came out of forages. You look at some of our breeders. You know, they migrated over from crops into turf. A lot of our forage specialists, in extension, were asked how to help a golf course or a sod field. So a lot of our foundation still goes back to not just C5, but C3 and some of the other divisions within our society
for the foundation.
It was mainly sports-driven, primarily by the golf. And when you look at what products we had to deal with, it's really what was registered, what was used in agriculture, and not nearly the degree of sophistication of product technology needed today. When you look at the cash value of an athletic field or a golf course, or even the replacement costs on home lawns, we needed better products. The trouble is we needed to find out what we had and what we needed. Our equipment was very limited. And one thing we learned in developing the professional lawn services, we had to build our equipment from ground up. And a lot of energy went into that in terms of how do we make this a cost-effective, safe, efficacious treatment to be able to service the needs of the customers in a route-based business. You go to the 80s and the 90s, this is really when I got my teeth cut, and we started seeing more and more industry. Chemical supply companies, seed houses, started investing a lot more money into either genetic improvement, product improvement, or even new product innovation. We saw the growth of equipment applications. So there's a lot of things going on that. So we evolved from using a farm-type formulated product into a specialty product. Because in this business, labor is our driving cost, and how do we go about doing the job efficiently so we can maximize the labor utilization but still do the job accurately? So we're putting only what's needed out on those properties. So we had to do a lot of work there to understand the evolution of equipment. And then while we had a research group, we had 20, 25 agronomists around the country that would advise the branches on how to do things. So the way lawn care is you have a branch that services a community. You have anywhere from 4 to 20 to even larger branches, 40 of these specialists that are out there daily calling on customers. And we don't own those properties, you mind. I'll talk a little bit about that. So we had to develop a lot of equipment going around that. So really during the 80s and the 90s, I would say tremendous growth in R&D. A lot of our leading companies developed specialty research teams that were in golf, but then all of a sudden evolved into understanding other elements of the turf grass industry. Where we're at in this century is C5 is still vibrant, but maybe what's changing is the influence of society looking at the value of these urban landscapes. And then with communities' interests, we're seeing a change in the regulatory communities and how do we educate them on what we're doing. So we're seeing really the governmental agencies, not just in our field, but in a lot of fields, are really kind of helping to do that. So the research had to evolve and understand the environmental fate. Product innovation. When I was hired on post-Vietnam, the whole issue is around the chlorophenoxies and the combination of 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D as Agent Orange and a contaminant in the 2,4-5-T as a 2,3-7-8 dioxin, very toxic. But people also transfer that risk over to the 2,4-D. So my first day on the job was finding an alternate for the phenoxies. So we spent years on that. And then all of a sudden there was a Kansas farm worker study 3 years later, and I got called in and into the office 4 in the afternoon. By Monday, I need your recommendations to replace broadleaf herbicides. They said 2,4-D. Goes, no, we're not going to use any of the chlorophenoxies. So I needed a solution by Monday. That kept me up. And I'll talk a little bit about what I learned from that experience. It was very foundational. But we've always got to be looking for alternates. You look at the water situation today. What are we finding? Breeders are looking. You got the USGA behind us trying to develop research to find out how do we deal with drought avoidance mechanisms. I played around with one of those. It avoided drought, but the recovery rate was extremely slow. So there's a lot more work needed in that area, but you know, water is a precious commodity in this world, and you see it on the golf course, you're going to see in home lawns. We have out in the Southwest that governments are paying people to pull out their lawns and put in synthetic turf or desert scapes. But I remember Jim Beard talking during the drought in California. He went to a lawn where they put in all the stone and gravel, and they come back 3 years later, and it was re-landscaped, and they asked why. They go, my air conditioning bills went through the roof. There's an environmental benefit. Maybe there's water consumption, but there was a cooling effect of a well-managed landscape that needs to be factored in. So let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, and this is where research becomes very important. We heard about synthetic turf and the heat buildup. My son played college level lacrosse, loved the field, but on hot days, it exhausted the players. So there's some balance needed in all of this. And then lastly, what we're seeing with some groups that just don't believe in the lawns as part of the urban environment, we just assume get rid of it and all the inputs. So we got to do this balance. So what is the justification? What is a reasonable amount of inputs we put into these urban landscapes? I had a professor when I was in graduate school, couldn't believe I was getting my PhD in turf. And he was a soybean plant pathologist. I said, do you have children? He goes, yeah. I said, well, good. I hope they enjoy playing soccer in your soybean fields this weekend. So how does lawn care really differ? Essentially, the model is 5 to 8 service visits based upon time of year and how many weeks of growing season you have. We're there primarily on the inputs, nutrients, and pest management. But our biggest challenge is educating the consumer on how they water and how they mow. It's hard to believe, but those two fundamental things are the most misunderstood work steps consumers have about caring their lawn and create more problems than anything we can sometimes resolve. It's a route-based business based upon the market's lawn size. It could be anywhere from 400 to 800 customers that a specialist would have to manage as part of their route responsibilities. So what I've done here below is I tried to identify what are some of the key variables and how do you compare and contrast three different areas of the use of turf grass. Over on your right, I'm a sod grower. Okay? My drivers of what I need to do is I'm trying to create a crop. And I want to get that crop to fill in as quickly as possible so I have a high-quality harvestable sod. My soil is generally good quality agricultural soil. My variability, I'm renewing those plants every 1 or 2 years depending on how much rhizome regrowth I may get on a bluegrass field. And my cultural practices are tightly controlled because I'm an on-site agronomist. I know when I need to water. I know when I need to put the input, the fertilizer. I know how often I need to mow it to build it, to get the grow in. And more importantly, I can target when I want to do that. The weather doesn't look right today, I can postpone things. A golf superintendent, again, professionally trained, but they're looking at the playability. There's more than just that, but they look at a lot of different elements. Their soil conditions are quite varied, depending on where you deal with an old push-up green construction to just moving soil around to create the contours on fairways and the bunkers to the very highly sophisticated soil media in a USGA green. So there is variability in that and how maybe plants are cultural. Again, they've got tight control over those cultural practices, the frequency of mowing, the cut of the mowing, how much water, what other additives they want to put in. And again, they can target their applications. So in the middle, the site's managed largely by a partnership between the homeowner and a lawn care professional. Our management key is appearance, but that's evolving. It's trying to get people to understand there's more to the lawn than just how free of weeds it is and how green it is. Try to look at the overall health and what are you doing to help contribute to that. And that's been the biggest challenge the last 10 years in this industry is getting customers to get off of this fix for the greenest, thickest, most weed-free lawn to accept that there's going to be some cosmetic defects. Let's manage for the overall balance of what you need to have that. I call it the outside living room. When I grew up, you'd run down to the park. Today, kids don't leave their backyard. So we've got to have green space. It doesn't need to be all lawn, but people still need that outdoor living space for their personal, recreational, family get-togethers. It's a very core of our society today. So, soils, I don't know why they even call it soil by the time a contractor gets in. My home, when I built it, I was the last lot on the street, and I found a tractor there. I found tons of cement. And then as I was digging trees for my holes, I found the soil line, 10 inches below, because they just take the overburden. And that's what we have to start with. So we have a lot of differences in there. Cultural practices, highly variable. We used to joke up in Michigan that they did not sell a lawnmower in Detroit that had wheels on it. I see Joe Rimmelsbach back there. We actually created these fluorescent cards to show them what the right mowing height would be. It was 3 years of just constant education to get people that, well, I don't like to mow my lawn, so I'm going to bring it down to 1 inch and let it grow up to 4 inches and mow it back down. But just think what that does, and then they want to know why they got weeds. And then our timing. As a route-based business, we have to figure out, so really, we're somewhere between 4 to 8 weeks between service intervals. So a lot can happen. So the industry has gone from when I started at 8-week intervals, we're down somewhere between 5 and 6 weeks. And it seems to be at the optimum time. So that's kind of where the industry has evolved. I want to talk a little bit about my role as a scientist then. Well, you put in the word lawn care, you put in golf, you put in sports. Those are all variables we all know we need to understand. The scientific approach is where my experience, where actually I got the greatest kick, if you will, as a scientist, going from a 3-year to in my 30th year, 35th year now, is trying to understand how do I take the scientific principles. And again, we all came out of an academic background. We had a research center. But the thing is, you always start with the replicated plot work. And we heard a study on terms of how visual ratings are done in comparative. And as your expert, you developed that. You can't rely upon that alone because I got to deal with what lawn care is about. So I need to understand the variability in natural populations. Our entomologists, we had to kind of design our own methodology to be able to get good quality data to do our rate titration and our timing studies or irrigation on the efficacy of an insecticide for grubs or understanding the population dynamics of a surface insect such as chinch bug. So we had to get off our research center. A lot of times we went out the field, but we had so much variability, we had to actually develop our own methodology for doing insect counts or even weed counts. The other thing, because we have so many diverse landscapes, we have such a wide window, our replication is not the traditional RCV, we all do, but we started testing our research on replication over time and location. I mentioned about my 2,4-D experience. Well, I thought I had the perfect mix. Very expensive, went out to the field, told the guys what to do, and all of a sudden I'm getting calls from my agronomist, this stuff's not working, or I got this problem, or I got that problem. Well, yeah, we were very precise, but we didn't account for variation in weather, we didn't account for variation in the fatigue factor of a specialist who's been out there for 6 lawns that day. And I just scrubbed all that work, and basically what I did was I went up and down Interstate 71, I was in Columbus, I go to Cleveland, and I go down to Cincinnati, and I replicated over time and distance, where I used our production equipment, and I developed the technique to treat 250 square feet with our spray equipment, and that's important, I'll talk in a minute. But we started finding out what is the quality and the consistency of our treatments that gave us the confidence that I can go now to 5,000 routes and say, this is the program, here's how you want to run it, here's the training you're going to need. Couldn't do that just with an RCB design. We have to go into the application methodology. Everyone says, oh, you're a 4-gallon spray volume. Well, they'll just take an 80-20 flat fan nozzle and walk slow. Well, it has nothing to do with particle size. So you need to understand, no matter what business you're in, is how will farmers or turf specialists use the equipment to get those products out. And then the other thing we tried to do to commercialize is what we call a split lawn or a T-test. And what we would do, where we had to deal with variation in natural populations, be it a grub material or a pre-emergent material, we would go into 4 or 5 cities around the U.S., and we'd just go out there knowing that these products we felt were pretty good. We knew the results. I would go through the center of a home, go left and right as a T-test between the current work practice and the proposed new work practice. And I'd get our specialists from there, I'd get the manager from there, and I'd get my scientists, and we just figure out, is the treatment equal to the current? Is it performing better or performing less? A simple T-test. And doing that, we also had the observational value to say, hey, we didn't see that in our research plots. All of a sudden, we could start picking out these plots because in the case of a pre-emergent, all of a sudden we started seeing weeds that were always a problem were no longer a problem in this one side. So again, you look at the scientific approach. It is science-based, but the challenge for you as researchers is think about maybe how do you do your work to provide your stakeholders in your state, your application technology, and think about timing. Everyone loves the picture postcard, and that sets the mind. It's kind of like dating in high school, and you can't wait to go to your high school reunion and see that person you thought was so wonderful, and all of a sudden it's a different picture. I know they say that about me. But, you know, we have grass types, soil conditions, cultural care, and weather, and this is not atypical. This may be different pictures within a neighborhood. It could be different pictures of time of year. But everyone desires the upper right. But yet, we're dealing with things in the lower. A new home on the bottom right, or winter kill in the slide on the left. So those are some of the challenges we have to be mindful of. So, what do we look at? In products, I need to understand duration. So if I'm looking at a material that has to have a residual property, a pre-emergent, or a soil insecticide, I need to know how long that product is going to be active. Again, I don't have that picture-perfect time to make the application. I got to be out there. If a critical date is this, I got to figure out how do I cycle through all my accounts to get that. So I got to be looking at the confidence level I have, not on a day one optimal data treatment, but over a wider window, which really gets to understand your rate response and things like that. How do you work around date optimization? I can't be at every property on the same day, so I've got to work that into my program. Application methodology. much different in our business than it is. We don't use fixed boom spray equipment. And the first day on the job, I go, you got to be kidding. This is how you're applying products. In fact, you call it the Kemlon gun. It's a very effective way, and I'll show you why in a minute. And then we got to make certain that our specialists know what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it. And then, as I said, the growing area now is how do you answer those community concerns? So let's talk a little bit about some of the trends in products. You know, in the 60s and 70s, I think golf, everyone just pushed very high end rates on turf, right? It was not uncommon, 6 to 8 pounds of nitrogen on a Pencross putting green, and what is it down to today? 2 pounds maybe? 3 pounds? Based on how much play you get? Turf went the same thing. We were all big on dormant fall fertilization because we saw the work that was done at a lot of different institutions, Kentucky, Rhode Island, Michigan State. But then all of a sudden we said, well, what about the pass-through? So we had to modify our practices in the 80s because I just didn't want to have this pass-through. More importantly, we had new customers coming on that didn't get the benefit of the fall. So finally, I made the decision we're not going up those high rates anymore. It's not the right thing to do. We're not executing the way it's planned. And by the way, the pass-through, which is now being discussed more and more in the late 90s and 2000s, has come to fruition. Development of sprayable control-release nitrogen sources. You know, the early days, we tried to use urea formaldehyde, finally ground powder blue. Very tough to handle. A lot of residue on the soil surface. Chuck Dare got involved and started looking, I'll talk a minute about other ways of using sprayable forms of controlled release nitrogen. Two issues there is burn protection from just the salts. The other thing is residual control to keep the lawn green over a longer period of time. TVA's development of sulfur-coated urea brought that in. Some good quality sulfur coat, not so good quality. So there's a lot of work there that had to go on understanding what made it good, and you've seen the evolution of that. And then all of a sudden you saw the introduction of iron. There was a lot of people really pushed iron, and frankly we got away from it because it's just a messy material, short-term response, and really not worth the benefit. It still has a place, but people are using it for aesthetics. It's now used more for where you truly have a micronutrient deficiency. Today, phosphorus use is limited. We've been very bullish on not using phosphorus. We've been in phosphorus-free in most of our markets for upwards of 10 years, and our soil test results are coming back. Even where clippings are being returned, we're starting to see a growing number of lawns that are phosphorus deficient, and we're seeing some of the side effects of that in terms of diseases and recovery. But yet we got a public policy that we're not going to use phosphates because of the effect. So a lot of work needs to understand what's happening. You know, Marty Petrovich's work showing keep the lawn healthy, you don't lose the phosphorus. But today it's given that phosphorus off lawns is creating all the problems with our lakes. And there's really no science to back it up, but that's kind of the emotional predicament we're in today. Plastic-coated urea has replaced the sulfur-coated ureas or combinations and given us more predictable response rates. And then more recently, we're seeing states restricting dates and rates of nitrogen application. You've got Virginia and Maryland around the Chesapeake Bay that put a cap on total N per grass type, and then also as you want to go above a certain level, how much more incremental slow release you must add. The ironic thing for me was at Virginia, I looked at their forage practices. I could go out 2 pounds of ammonium nitrate in the spring and 2 pounds of ammonium nitrate in the fall. But yet they're telling me turf can only use 2 pounds of nitrogen. You talk about loads. So there's a lot of ambiguity in understanding the differences. But these are things that we're seeing with today. Pesticide use. Ag-grade formulas. My first day on the job, I was sent down to Atlanta to understand why we had all these splotchy dead lawns. And we're using an ag formulation of a pre-emergent. Our agronomists down there dealing with winter kill had increased the rates of potassium that fall in that spring. And then our formulator decided, well, ammonium polyphosphate's too expensive. Without telling us, he went over to monoammonium phosphate. And basically, the salt level got so high, it broke down the emulsifiers in the formulation, created clabber, if you know what that is. But just think of a atrazine, a wettable powder, with a free oil out of an emulsifier, you get window putty. And this was coming out the end of the gun, and we didn't know what it was until we started interviewing our specialist. Yeah, I had this stuff, and I finally got a sample of it. It was 90% atrazine. We broke the formulation on sound agronomic practices, but we didn't have the formulation that we needed for our kind of work. So I went from a weed scientist to a formulation chemist in 1 year. Widespread use versus targeted. When I got here, you know, you guys, well, let's just spray everything. No, that's not the right thing to do. And trying to just get it, and now we have to develop equipment to allow efficiency so we can make the application as needed, where needed, and only when needed. And then, back then, risks were very poorly understood. What is the Urantia interval? What is the effect on consumers? What is the effect on our employees? So we had a whole health and safety group. We had a board-certified toxic hazard screen. Every product we ever wanted to use, and we monitored all of our employees for health. 80s and 90s, lawn care operated formulations came up, both in the fertilizers we were using. Targeted use started to evolve. We started developing equipment and multiple tanks on trucks. Vastly improved pest knowledge. In fact, Joel Rimmelsbach, remember that? You guys discovered white patch on Toff Fescue, right? He ran our diagnostics lab for a number of years and was a great resource to the field. So we found a lot of funky things, and we had. So we found pests. And today we're having problems with the spread of grub complexes changing. Out east was primarily, you know, you deal with mantis, chafer, Japanese beetle. Well, now we're dealing with oriental beetle, Asiatic beetle. So the grub complexes change, and their susceptibility to insecticides is wildly different. People said, well, it's accelerated degradation. I think it's just we got a different species complex we didn't understand 20 years ago. And then again, health, safety, environmental concerns continue to rise. So going forward, folks like the Bayer and others, they're really customizing. The ag community has developed fertilizers. The technology we have today, I think, is very, very good. We're away from broadcast application, more targeted. We're finding additional pest problems emerging. And then the one at the bottom there is probably the one that's probably the biggest pest for us is unreasonable misunderstanding of the regulations needed to protect our community. And you heard some of that earlier this week. Okay, I purposely used a cartoon because I don't want to bore you with data. But if the red is the perfect time to put down a pre-emergent, the lawn care operator's got to look at the WIS. So that's what I mean by duration. I got to know my timing, and it evolved how we looked at products. And the first major change in pre-emergence with pendimethalin, we found out it had early post-activity, and I could get 2 to 3 weeks of post-activity. Dithiopyr came along next. I can go up to one tiller. So it changed our thinking of how we looked at products. So we need to understand use rate sequentials. There's a lot of work that goes into it that is really probably not so much you folks would be interested, but when you're trying to operationalize agronomics, we have to look at some of those items. Application methodology. You look at liquid applications. In Florida, they believe you need to be 8 gallons per thousand because you had to get the product off the leaves down where the chinch bugs were. There was no data to support that, but that was a belief, and everyone had these trucks that were flooding lawns with 8 gallons. I hear people say, well, 4 gallons is an awful amount of liquid, 174 gallons the acre. Break it out to a square foot, it's not that much moisture. But now we're hauling around a lot of freight. So we're dealing with fuel consciousness, running around 18 pounds of weight for 1,000 square feet, or 32 pounds in the 4 gallon, we went to a 2 gallon rate, had to change our spray practices and other things. We had to test, so we found there was a little bit higher burn potential. We tried to go as low as 1.5 gallons, and it didn't work. So pretty much the industry now is on a 2 gallon spray volume. With that, we've got to get effective product placement and effective spray coverage. We've got to be worried about efficacy versus drift. So the Chemlon gun was designed. It's literally the droplet sizes. If you got up this morning and took a shower, that's about the size of the spray droplets emitted by that gun. You're dealing with about 2.5 pounds of pressure behind the nozzle. When the gun is open, it's 8 pounds at the back of the nozzle. But back at the truck, it could be upwards of 120 because you've got 400 feet of hose. You got all that reduction in flow to get that flow rate. We looked at spray drift, and it's less than 1% is greater than less than 250 microns. Most people consider 100 microns or smaller as driftable fines. But today, the EPA does not differentiate spray equipment and application technology. They just got a cap on wind speed. And as I tell our guys, I could take an old 5-gallon barrel, drill a hole in it, put a weed spray wand through that with the bucket over the weed, and if it's over 10 miles per hour, I can't make that application. They took away the methodology, whether I'm spraying aerially or drop spread or whatever, the wind speed is the wind speed. It didn't care about application methodology. And that's been a breakthrough that happened in the last 5 years. With those larger spray droplets, there's certain weed species you're not going to control. Spurge in the summer, oxalis in the summer, crabgrass with certain things. So we need to understand spray droplet, spray volume, as it affects selectivity as well as efficacy. And I mentioned that the spray technique, it looks haphazard, but it's rather precise. And do you think about it, how many landscapes that you know in your home area that are square or rectangular? They're all different shapes. Think about trying to spray a lawn with a uniform application where you have all this variance. So with this gun, you can actually trim out areas, keep stuff off the pavement, whether it's a small double strip parkway or around ornamentals. It's a very effective tool, but it does take training. It's easily reproducible. We've done a lot of work on that, and it's been very effective when applied. Granulars, a lot of evolutionary equipment. No one knew what a jet deflector was, and with the push on keeping products off pavement, you need to be, you know, as educators, teaching these guys, spend the extra $200 and get a spreader that has a jet deflector on it. I know I'm working with Scott's people at a water summit. You know, you look at the surface area of risk. With these jet deflectors, it's a very, very, very low percent of granules that even land on pavement, and you can blow those or sweep those back. So there's ways we as the industry can be responsible and accountable to our environment by just using the right equipment and training our people correctly. On fertilizers, our release characteristics, we've done a lot of work in that area. And frankly, if you go down today, at the bottom of methylene ureas was probably the best slow-release nitrogen source ever developed. Scott's had a product called 4100, and we would use it as a suspension. Then we worked with some shorter-chain urea from aldehydes, kind of like Elmer's glue. Sadly, if the reaction wasn't stabilized, it ended up more like custard. Those have kind of phased out. So today, most of the liquid nitrogen sources are methyl or trizone ureas, and they're used primarily for burn protection. And as I mentioned earlier, the coated ureas have evolved, and there are some very fine quality products out there. Everyone wants an alternate. And we spend a lot of time doing focus groups, understanding, and, you know, Ben, we're trying to push the government says, use those biosolids. Well, you ask a customer, how do they feel about manure? And then you ask them about biosolids, and they say, well, what's that? We explain, well, it came from your local treatment center. Well, what's in it? What'd you put in the toilet this morning? Big reaction. They didn't buy it. But yet, you got agencies. And then, frankly, the heavy metals. I don't know if you remember the Milorganite issue with NFL football players. And if you look at the Milorganite label, I don't know if it's changed, but it used to say that do not use this land for vegetable gardens or other produce production if it's been treated with Milorganite. Think about the liability we would inherit with that. So we wouldn't use it. So you got to be careful. Now, they've done a better job, but the heavy metals is an issue that, and listening to urban gardening, when I was at UMass, they had this thing, Food for Century 21, I think it was. Anyhow, the governor really wanted to protect the farmlands in the Connecticut River Valley and take back these blighted areas and turn them into victory gardens because, you know, Crockett was a graduate of UMass. Our soil chemist went and said, do you realize how much lead is in these soils? And you're telling people to go in these urban areas and putting radishes and lettuce, which is extracting those heavy metals and putting it into the food portion. So turf is probably needed in those areas just to keep those environmental contaminants at bay. Bridge products, people trying to give I got an organic program. I liken it to, if I don't like alcohol, I'm not interested in a natural light beer. Using a bridge product for someone who does not want anything but natural, you're just deceiving ourselves. So we offer that, but it's not. I mean, I'll go to my customer and say, if you really want a natural program, let's do it all natural. If you don't want the weeds control, just let me know. And we really turned it into, we're not telling them what to do anymore. We're saying, what would you like? How would you like it done? What about? And we work with them. So again, I'll show you in a minute about societal values coming into this. But you can't be high and mighty about what we're dealing with. You're dealing with lay people and products and with the awareness people have, both environmental or if they got children. The biggest risk or biggest concern we have is not about from the expectant family. It's from the people that brought home a six-week-old puppy. They're more concerned about the health of their puppy than they are their children sometimes. It kind of boggles my mind. Softer pesticides. A lot of work's been going in that area. These are very narrow in spectrum, very difficult to get good duration out of it. We spent a lot of money trying to develop biological alternatives using nematodes and neem oils and all that in the insecticide area. And frankly, I think we probably spent 10 years on it. We could not get anything. We looked at product from Australia to Europe to America, just could not find anything that was effective that would meet our thing. In Canada, there was a McGill University had found a sclerotinia spore that was effective on broadleaf weeds. Great research. We were going to invest in it. They were using a mushroom grower in Pennsylvania to mass produce this. Well, to do it, we had to put in refrigeration units on our branches. And it was a granular product, so we had to make certain there's plenty of dew on the ground for the treatment to stick. And by the way, it didn't really work that well on mature weeds. Up there today, with the cosmetic pesticide ban in Toronto, they're using a chelated form of iron, $200 to the acre. And it takes two applications. And yet, they say they don't want to use pesticides, but what's the difference between a chelated iron and maybe some other products more simpler in design like a glyphosate? But you know, but that's kind of what we're dealing with. The reality is in Toronto, 60% of the voters live in apartments. So when you looked at the demographics and the politics, there's those that had suburban areas wanted it done responsibly, but the voting population didn't have any skin in the game. They said, yeah, we don't need pesticides. So it changed what's going on up there. You look at safety now as a matter of perception. We had Frank talk about the issue with neonics. And the question is that the science, there's going to be perception. It's a challenge all of us have. A bunch of years back, I talked to you folks because we were under the watch glass with a refuse to use Chemlon campaign by this strong activist group. And when I go in and look at their quotations, they were taking C5 scientists' literature out of context. They were representing information that there's no basis for it. And then their quotes were for non-scientists. Landscape architects were being quoted, but no one from C5 was stepping up or being asked to comment on what does it take to responsibly care for a lawn. So we do need to be engaged. We are the leaders. We have the knowledge. Don't be afraid to speak up because you know what is the right thing to do and how to do it. I've had people say, what if a product comes in the risk? Then we remove it. It's not worth it to me. So we're always constantly looking for different ways to do things. I spent a lot of time in bystander exposure looking at spray drift. I mentioned some of that. Reentry. We had no data. We said stay off the lawns and you need to look at the EPA until the product is dried or the dust has settled. And you heard that paper yesterday. If you saw dislodged residues where morning dew could rehydrate. So we've done a lot of work in that area. I understand formulation is a big factor. Wettable powder will slough off easier than if you use an emulsifiable concentrate or something. So technology can really reduce that off-target application. But the good news is these things do drop off rapidly. The oversimplification would just water in. Well, again, the watering in would work with certain formulations, not the others. But the natural degradation of these products, you're down less than 1% of the applied rate within 3 days of application. So when I have a customer ask me about things, we kind of give them some ideas on what to do, and we'll reschedule around their concerns. We just can't say, trust us, we know what we're doing. That does not fly in the public anymore. And then of late, pollinators on lawns and the whole issue on surface runoff are really probably the two big factors going on in this decade. All right, so let's kind of shift gears. Where is it today? We had hired a new marketing manager, really a sharp guy, and he's trying to understand the business. And I wrote down on a napkin, I said, it's about three things. It's about me, my lawn, and my community. He asked me about it. I said, well, if it's about me, are you easy to do business with? Are you thinking about my children? Are you thinking about my schedule? It's about my lawn. Well, that's a very emotive. I really want the nicest looking lawn in America. Okay, we can work with you if you got the right inputs to start with, the right grass type. But I'm also worried about my next door neighbor and the kids that might be out playing. So that's kind of the way I've always gone to market the last 10 years is, can I answer those three questions? And what are we doing as we evolve the science into practice to address that? It's a very emotional buy. Customers are much better educated today, but they still have the tie to lawn. It's amazing. Customers I've talked to, they're so unreasonable because there's something wrong with their lawn. You thought we'd taken their child from them. And we have to kind of educate them on how we can work with them. But the next door neighbor, they got to live with them. We have a lot of customers that will cancel because, hey, I trust what you guys are doing, but I got to live with George next door, and George does not like the idea that I'm using you as a service provider. How do I communicate with them what we're doing? So we have to be mindful of that. When we look at that lawn, I talk about the outside living room. You know, the old mantra is thicker, greener, more weed-free. Today it's more about how do I enjoy my lawn? How do I can be making dinner at night, and I can look out the back window and know where my children are, and I don't have to worry about them. I want to have my picnic out the backyard with my children this weekend. Is it okay for me to be having a garden, have my kids play in the yard you just treated earlier this week? What about these organic options? What do you even tell me about them? So those are the types of things that we're dealing with today, and products, developers, users, and probably even you at the community at the science level are being asked probably by your own peers. And then what I call is understand the risk versus the benefit, Community concerns are growing, and we cannot dismiss them. We all live in a community. We've got to live with one another. So we need to understand and what's going on in that area. So what's needed? I'll bring it down. Innovation, environment, and education. Innovation, we talked a lot about the different things to be looking at. But today it's product efficiency, but also looking at water conservation and more effective, efficient use of nutrients. And frankly, I think we need to be looking at alternate ground covers. There's not been a lot of work done where you look at a mixture of forbs with grasses. And there was a lot of work that was done in the 70s out in California at Oregon State. I think there's a place to really evaluate what makes up a lawn. You know, so we've got to think through some of these things as we go forward. What are the reduced risks products that are available that are not, do they truly offer a lower risk? And I gave the example of biosolids. IPM has been talked about, but how effective has it been in moving the needle on product use? So there's more work needed in that day. And then the more we learn about pesticide fate and being able to communicate, I think more work is needed in this area, particularly around the dissipation rates for reentry, but also any off-target. And this is a good example of pollinator issue going on right now. Do lawns actually have value? I had a marketing guy want to put this thing in the, tell me why it's good to kill weeds. I said, you got to be kidding me. Well, it's got to be environmental benefit. Kind of hard to rationalize that. But we have to ask ourselves, do lawns have value? And at what level of quality do we need to sustain what the consumer wants out of that grassed area in their community? They don't need 100% of the plot, their land area, in lawn. But you can't play in a soybean field, and it's pretty hard to walk out and enjoy your gardens if you don't have that green carpet there on wet, muddy days. The area right now I see is, when you look at what we call health risk, is the inherent hazard by the exposure. Today, focuses on the hazard, but not looking. And that's what the agency does with their risk assessment. But all too often, the hazard is taken out of context to the exposure. And when you deal with this, you've got to be mindful of that. And then how do we balance those benefits versus not only the real risk, but the perceived risk? It gets into communication. Our workforce today, we have right now about, at peak season, we'll have about 6,000 specialists out on properties every day. So these are entry-level jobs. Some guys will make it a career. Some, it's just something until they find something different. But we have to make certain that they're responsible in how they do things. So we really have to start with the very foundation and give them the basic skills. More importantly, how do they solve the problem so they know what to do, when to do it, and they understand the difference. As simple as you and I think between a broadleaf weed and a grassy weed, we see it with consumers. I see it with my son trying to tell me that the guy at Home Depot knew more about lawns than me, and why in October he needs to put down merit to deal with the moles that were chewing up his lawn. Future leaders. You know, we've seen a shift in turf grass students' employment opportunities, and I think this is an area that is often overlooked as a career path. It's not for everyone, but neither is golf. I started in golf, and I got out of it for reasons I had for my own reason. But the other thing is when you deal with your training, if you deal with your extension, we had a former a person, Joanne Kickrack, she came in and spoke to us about adult education because she was doing the pesticide training for the state of Ohio. And we had to really revisit what adult learning theory you use. It's kind of like, what's in it for me? So we had to really change how we approach educating the non-agricultural-based community on how to do things, when to do it, and why. It changes how you deal with your communication messages and extension. College-trained managers, I'm in my 35th year, 38 years postgraduate work, and the thing that I worry most about is where's the next generation of leaders going to come from. I spent a lot of time developing my direct professional staff and make certain I got succession planning for them. I want to retire, but I got to have the responsibility the company's done so well for me to make certain they got it. We need agronomically trained managers, but they will probably have a different requirement than what you're thinking about in golf and sports turf management. We need to balance the science with the business needs. I think that's even true for golf superintendents today under the constraints that they're under. They need both soft and hard skills. They got to be able to lead people. My biggest problem in finding people to come into some of the jobs I'd like to do is their leadership skills are lacking. Communication skills, to be able to talk to customers or talk to that supervisor. And then the analytical skills. How do I make a decision? What do I do? So I just ask you to think, as you're evolving your curriculum for your students and thinking, someone that wants to go into a different career track, I think these are things, as educators, you need to be mindful as you develop the next generation of leaders for this industry. And now, that's my 2 cents worth. Thank you.
We have a couple minutes for questions. Any questions for...